This is On and Off Your Mat Podcast, episode 224, The Breath, Eastern Philosophy and Nervous System Science. If you love to nerd out and understand how things work or why they work, today's episode on the breath is for you and will help you connect the dots between what you already know from other episodes about the nervous system, polyvagal theory, even heart rate variability, with the nadis, the gunas, the vayu, and so on within the yoga tradition. For today's episode, I sat down with Dylan Werner. Dylan is a renowned yoga instructor and author known for his expertise in breathwork, meditation, hand balancing, and movement. He founded Myofascial Integrated Alignment and Myofascial Integrated Stretching, which are asana-based systems that combine scientific principles with movement to improve overall health and posture. With a yoga practice spanning over 20 years and teaching experience since 2011, Dylan has taught in more than 60 countries, leading hundreds of workshops, training, and lectures to thousands of students. His online classes have attracted millions of views from his global audience, and Dylan currently offers most of his teaching online on his own platform. We sat down to talk about why we breathe, which might seem like a silly question, but stay with me. How to breathe, also, you're like, isn't that something we do automatically? And the way the breath is capable of influencing us emotionally, physically, and spiritually. We also covered some pranayama exercises and how to sequence your pranayama just as you would sequence an asana practice. If this episode inspires you in any way, share it and help someone else on their journey of accessing the benefits of yoga and using those to navigate their life. I always love to read your takeaways on the episode, so take a screenshot of the episode, share something you've learned on Instagram, and make sure to tag either at On and Off Your Mat Podcast or erica.philander. And I'll be happy to see them and I will reshare you. All right, if you're ready to jump into today's episode with Dylan, let's go. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, Erica.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me onto your podcast.
For listeners that don't know you very well yet, I'm sure most of them already have an idea of who you are. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey? The cliff notes.
I'm a yoga teacher. I currently live in Bali. I've been teaching yoga since 2011, practicing for about 22, 23 years now, maybe a little longer. Yeah, that's it. I wrote a book. Yeah, but mostly I'm just teaching online right now and some in-person intensives, but I've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, time flies, right? When you like look back and you're like, it's been 20 something years.
Yeah, I'm 43 now already, which is kind of crazy to me how quick it's gone. Because I remember when I first started teaching at 30, 31 is kind of like when I first started teaching. And I remember back then thinking like, who's going to listen to me? Even though I had quite a bit of experience as a practitioner, but thinking like there's a big difference between 30 and 40 of how you feel about yourself. I'm sure like most teachers out there, when you first start getting into it, you have this imposter syndrome, this feeling like you're not qualified, you're not good enough. I always thought I was like an asana teacher, but I wasn't a yoga teacher. But yeah, I think if we talk about the big journey, I lost the imposter syndrome.
Did you find it again writing the book, or was it lost completely?
Writing the book was really easy. I remember meeting with my publisher. I had this idea of writing a book. I actually wanted to write several books. I still want to write quite a few more books. I just haven't taken the time. I do have time to do it. I just haven't taken it. But I remember having the discussion with my publisher about writing this book. And they reached out to me, a publishing company called Victory Belt. They do a lot of mindfulness style books. And the publisher and his wife had been practicing with me online for a few years. And so they kind of had an idea of who I was and just felt like a really good fit. Well, the first book I really wanted to write was a poetry book. I'm still kind of working on that one. It was on myofascial integrated alignment, which is kind of my system of yoga.
Yeah.
And I pitched him the idea and he says, oh, that sounds great. And I'm like, yeah, there's going to be like so much work in the research area. And even though it's something that I developed, a lot of the information out there is fairly new and evolving and stuff. And I felt like even my own teaching and practice with it was still evolving. And breathwork had been something that I've been teaching for also like a decade when I wrote it. And so I pitched him that book and he's like, that's it. And it was kind of around the time when there was more focus on breathwork. And like most of the focus on breathwork out there has been around like Wim Hof. Like when people hear breathwork, they think of that But now when people hear breath work, they think of like conscious connection or rebirthing breath, or they're all a bunch of different names for basically hyperventilating. How do we do this breath work a little bit different? I guess like hypertrophic breathing is the most technical name for it, which I've also done and practiced a lot and taught, but it's a very small, like almost non-existent part of my breath practice. I kind of wanted to share more of like how pranayama is really actually effective from not just a yogic philosophical standpoint, because I don't know if you've ever read like Light on Pranayama by Iyengar, which is obviously a classic book in pranayama, or any the older text of which that's based on. But a lot of it is kind of like a pseudoscience, like do this as your master tells you or as your guru tells you, and you will have all the benefits that you could ever possibly imagine.
Yeah, full enlightenment.
Yeah. And so I wanted to get something that both held on to like the Eastern philosophy, the spirituality of breathing that comes, which is essentially just an emotional change. Like spirituality is felt through emotions, right? We feel enlightened emotionally. We feel closed emotionally. Really everything that we experience in the world first comes through our emotions. So spirituality is just a lens on how do we understand ourselves emotionally, really in that aspect. Where the other side of it, like the science side, is more of like what's actually changing physically. Well, as a physical body changes, the emotional body is connected. Like we have two sides of the spectrum. We have the physical side or whatever, what's going on here. And then we have the emotional side on the other side. Or you could say it's like the logical versus creative, or however you want to divide up that spectrum, but it's still the same line. And there's a blending between it. You're never removed from one. Even if you're all the way on the other opposite end of the spectrum, you're never removed from that because it's still the same spectrum. It's still, you know, the same line that you're on. And so I wanted to bring something that was a little bit more concrete. And I wanted to really kind of compare where yoga philosophy said, like, here's the benefits versus what's actually happening. Because the science of breath is relatively easy to understand. There's four parts of the breath. It's really easy to understand. You're changing your physiology and your chemistry, your blood chemistry, based on how fast you breathe, how slow you breathe, if you hold your breath. And it's only a couple parts. You have an inhale, you have a breath retention at the top of the inhale, you have an exhale, and you have breath retention at the bottom of that. And then, of course, you have all the stages in between. But those have a direct physiological effect on you. And that physiological effect affects our nervous system, autonomic nervous system, parasympathetic, sympathetic, which is where our emotions are based off of. And so I started to lay out these different maps of, I know I'm kind of going off here, starting with like how we started, but I'm pitching this to him, how I want to do it. And as I was pitching him the book, I realized I had the entire book already in my head. There was a single part of it that I didn't know that wasn't going to go into it. And so I was actually in Bali and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to start writing the book here. I have 2 months before my next tour is coming up. So I'm going to get into it. And I started writing it. And then I went to London to start that tour. And I remember in here, like sitting in the sauna and some guys talking about this possible pandemic starting. Right. And this is before anybody had known anything or heard of anything. It's just like, hey, watch out. There's this new type of flu that's coming out and be really wary, like if you're going to travel. And so like I kind of took it with a grain of sand, grain of salt.
We got it.
It was one of those. I took it lightheartedly and then went to London and was staying at a friend's house who was in France. And that's when the pandemic hit and I got locked down there. And I was like, wow, what a perfect time for this to happen. You know, even though it's like an awful thing for the world, it gave me the opportunity to sit down and focus. And I wrote the book in about a month or so of like,
that's incredible.
Just sat down at my computer every day, would write, research, because I knew all the information because I'd been studying it for so long, but I needed to also have the references to back it. Because like a yoga book, you could get away with just feelings and thoughts and prayers or whatever, you know, like you could put anything out there. It doesn't necessarily have to have any backing because as far as yoga philosophy is concerned, you could talk about one thing and there's 50 or 60 different points of view on that. And so like, I felt really comfortable. And also in my background of yoga philosophy, I felt really comfortable with that, even though there was quite a bit of research into that, which really was like the hardest research. Because when you start researching yoga,
rabbit holes after rabbit holes.
Oh my God. And not only that, how it contradicts itself in so many different ways, you know, like from one great teacher to another, from one thing to another. And so what I really had to work through was the parts that seemed to speak truth that weren't contradicting each other, and focus on that part of the philosophy, which actually really helped me understand my own sense. So whenever you write a book, you learn so much about it. And then added the science stuff into it and shared a little bit of my journey. I read a lot of breath books. And what I found with like a lot of these breath books or even any other kind of philosophy book, when you get into it, it's about half of most of these books are stories, which is people learn through stories. So it makes sense, but like more anecdotal kind of things like, oh, Susie, this, whatever, did this, and she had this result. Like I have a science background, which has really helped me. Seeing that, you know, that is the worst type of evidence. Personal experience is the lowest form of evidence out there, but it's one that we value the most, which is kind of an interesting thing. So I knew I needed to put like my own personal bit into it, but I didn't want it to be the forefront of the book, like a lot of these other books that I've read.
To water down.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also at the time I was writing it, James Nestor just came out with his book, Breath, and I didn't read it because I didn't want to be influenced by it, which is, by the way, a great book. So any listeners out there that haven't read that book, it's a good book.
Want to dive deeper?
Yeah, well, that book doesn't dive deeper by any means, but it tells one story that's really important, and he does it better than anyone else. And that story is breathe through your nose. His whole book, that's the only point that he really makes. He talks about a lot of things. He talks about a lot of great things, but the one point that he does incredibly well is he teaches you to breathe through your nose. I do that in my book, but it's definitely not the focus.
Your center point, yeah.
The center point in my book is, well, first of all, what do these pranayama practices do, right? Because like, what's the difference between breath of fire, Kapala Bhati, yeah, right? They're all hyperventilations through the nose. They work a little bit different. How do they affect us physiologically versus emotionally, which those two are intertwined? So like I break down those kinds of things. So the first month I spent writing it, the second month I spent illustrating it. So I did all the illustrations and the cover in it, which I'm not an artist by any means, but I had a lot of time and I was working with their art team. And I was like, I know exactly what I want it to look like.
I have it in my head.
Like I could kind of draw a little bit. So I'm just going to do it. And so I told my publisher, I'm just going to do all the illustrations. They're like, really? Oh, okay. And I sent it to them. They're like, perfect. This is great. So it worked out.
Yeah, that's lovely. So guys, if you don't know, we're talking about the book called The Illuminated Breath, which is your book. And you've already said so much things as like your introduction of like your pitch in the book, which are things we can go a little bit deeper. And I feel like this might be a silly question to start, but you did talk about how it's simple, what the breath is from that physiological perspective. Why do we breathe, or what does the breath actually do? Can you start us there?
The easiest answer, I think the one that everybody knows, is we breathe to live. Obviously, oxygen is fuel for the body. For us to create energy, we need oxygen and we need sugar, essentially, which creates ATP, energy. And from that, from the energy, we also have a byproduct of CO2 and water. All the chemistry is also laid out in the book. So that's kind of like the first thing. We're essentially breathing for energy, basically. The other thing that's a little less talked about, I mean, it is out there, especially if you're reading breath books, but how the breath affects our nervous system. This is actually really easy to see because of heart rate variability, which when I was writing the book, like heart rate variability was something out there, but I think just in the past few years, especially things like Oura Ring that has become popular since then. I actually had an Oura Ring back then, but I had like the first generation. So things like that become popular. So people know about HRV a lot more than when I wrote the book, but it's simple. So heart rate variability, for those that don't know, is basically measuring the R to R. So the R waves, you have your EKG or ECG, electrocardiogram, which is basically a graph representation of your heartbeat. And so you have a P wave, QRS complex, ST segment, and T wave. So this is kind of what we look at it. When you see this little heartbeat graph, that's what you're looking at. Well, the biggest spike on there is called the R wave. And that's the contraction of the ventricle. So when your heart actually beats. So when you look between R wave to R wave, there's a time between that beat. And when you look at lots of them, that's when you get your pulse. So let's say your heart is beating 60 times per minute. Well, 60 times per minute is not one beat on the second. That would mean that it's very regular. If it is one beat on the second, that means you're highly in your sympathetic nervous system. And so there's a lot of science to go into this. But the simple way to look at it is the more regular that heartbeat is, the more sympathetic tone you have, because the sympathetic tone controls the regularity of it. The more irregular it is, the more that the heart breathes. So you'll see like it gets longer and shorter between your breaths. We're breathing maybe 15 times per minute on average. So you're obviously taking a lot less breaths than your heart is beating. If your heart's beating 60 times per minute, you're breathing 15 times per minute, you're going to see the heart kind of breathe, you know, and there's a lot of yoga practices that talk about breathing with the heart. Well, this is actually scientifically proven in that your heart does breathe. As you inhale, inhalations are connected to the sympathetic nervous system. So as I inhale, my heart rate speeds up. Mm-hmm. As I exhale, exhales are connected to the parasympathetic nervous system. So it slows down. And this creates an irregularity, but it's a positive irregularity.
Yeah, because it's adapting.
Right. So this is where we get heart rate variability. The variability of the heart rate, essentially, the more variability that you have, generally it's shown for the healthier that you are, which is kind of counterintuitive. Like, I think most people would think the more regular your heart is, the better it is. The more irregular it is, it shows you that you're able to get into your sympathetic tone better. And this isn't a number that anyone should really focus on so much, except for like your own number. Like, you should never compare your number to someone else's number if you're looking at your own personal HRV, because there's a lot of different factors that go into it. But once you start monitoring for a long time, you could see the trends in it. When your HRV is higher, that's a sign of good recovery. It's why I use it the most for fitness and stuff. It's why most people use it, because if you have a higher HRV, it shows that you have more recovery. But also, like, emotionally, if your HRV is really low, it could be a sign of chronic stress. And so it's a good thing to kind of cue into. But based off of this, as I know, if I inhale, it's sympathetic. So I exhale, it's parasympathetic. And so I can start seeing how breathing affects my physiology. If I breathe fast, it's sympathetic. If I breathe slow, it's parasympathetic. Holding my breath is a form of breathing slow. So if I hold my breath, it's going to be parasympathetic. And there's other like nuances into it. That's a physiological response to it, but you also have an emotional response to this as well. So like, if you hold your breath on your own, if you do it to a certain point, it'll be parasympathetic. But if you keep holding it and you start to create like a panic in your mind that you can't breathe, it becomes sympathetic. Or if somebody holds your breath for you, obviously.
Yeah, it's going to kick in sympathetic faster.
This isn't any kind of new science. People have known this for a really long time. And so what I did is I took this, and actually, I don't really love so much the classical sympathetic parasympathetic nervous system, because it isn't as correct as other models of it, especially with the fight or flight or rest and digest, which is kind of what it's associated with. So I looked more towards what's called the polyvagal theory. And the polyvagal theory is a three-part theory. I'm sure you're familiar with it, right?
Yeah. And we've talked about it a lot on the podcast as well. So go in there. They know what you're talking about.
So your listeners should be very familiar with it. But it's a three-part system, right? You have ventral vagal, dorsal vagal, and then your parasympathetic. Ventral vagal is kind of like your social engagement. It's the hierarchy. It's the healthy balance of it. So this would be your sattvic state, or this would be shishumna. Like, if we start bringing in the yoga terms, and so you could see how these three states overlap onto the breath. So I used basically four different maps to show how the breath navigates the body. Like, if you have a map of anything, your map is just a representation of what is going on. And you look at different aspects of that map, depending on how you want to navigate it. So if you're looking to go somewhere in that map, let's say by car, you're going to look at the roads. If you're looking to hike somewhere, maybe you want to hike a mountain, you might look at the topography. If you're looking to build somewhere, you might look at building codes and sections and what are zoned for what. So zoning things, you know what I mean? So the map is the same map, the same place, but you're going to use different representations of things on that map to understand how to navigate with that. And that's how I try to break it down in the book. So you have the, how is my body responding to hyperventilation versus hypoventilation? And this is going to affect sympathetic versus parasympathetic. And these are the organs that it's going to affect. These are the systems that it's going to affect. This is how it's going to affect it based on what you do. Well, that same thing, if I look, okay, well, how does it affect the gunas? Well, what are the gunas? And this is where I kind of took a little bit of liberties, but I also did a lot of cross-referencing, I guess, maybe with my gurus, my mentors who have been teaching yoga. Like my main teachers are both in their mid-70s now. They've taught on my past teacher trainings. But like one of my teachers, her name is Mercy. She is 72. And she's been doing yoga since she was 16, and she studied with Swami Satchidananda and Amma and Baba Hari Das and like all these like great old Indian gurus. And so like I had this idea and I'm like, well, you know, this isn't exactly how it goes into it, but like when I put things against the science, it makes a lot more sense into these ways on this interpretation of it. And it becomes a lot more useful, especially things like the Vayus. You know, the Vayus, which is, Vayu means wind. And so you have the Prana Vayus, the five ways that energy moves through the body. Well, you have Udana Vayu that moves up the central channel. You have Samana Vayu, which draws everything in. Dhyana Vayu that pushes everything out. Apana Vayu, which moves everything down. Prana Vayu, the most important one, which some texts will say also moves up. Some will say prana comes in and out. So like, I really like that because prana means breath, vitality. And so I went with the model of how prana works between outside energy and inside energy. So like I started to map out the Vayus of how does it represent something and how is it useful? Well, the Vayus represent our relationship to all things. And so when we understand what our relationship is and how that's connected to our nervous system and how that's connected to the breath, we could use the breath to affect these relationships. And like any tool, the tool is only as good as the thing that you're working on, right? So if you're an artist and you have a paintbrush and a canvas, well, if your canvas has holes in it and it's dirty, it doesn't matter how fine your paintbrushes are, how appropriate your paintbrushes are, your final product isn't going to be that good. So with all of these systems, it's also about understanding how to use the tool, but how to work with the canvas. And so, you know, if we're talking about like, yeah, the Vayus like relationships, like prana Vayu is our relationship between outer nature and inner nature, prana out, prana in, which is source nature. When the outer nature and the inner nature are unified, when we understand that the outside is the same as the inside, that we start to understand our true nature. Samana Vayu and Vijnana Vayu. Samana gathers everything and brings it towards the center. Vijnana moves everything out. Well, these are opposing actions. Exhale and inhale, parasympathetic, sympathetic. But also talks about relationships. My love for others, Vijnana Vayu, outwards. This is more in sympathetic. We think about showing love is a doing action, right? This is in our sympathetic. This is how we love the world. Well, the opposite of that is
the receiving.
The receiving. This is parasympathetic. This is the yin and yang. This is the inhale and the exhale. So we look at these relationships. And what we're trying to do with most things is find balance. First, we have to work on our own personal life, but something that could help us do that are the tools. So like our breath. So if I have trouble loving myself, I'm obviously going to have trouble loving other people. And if I'm only loving other people, you know, you see these like people that are people pleasers. They just want to do everything for everybody else, but nothing for themselves. Well, there's going to be a great imbalance there. And so I can work with the breath to start to bring my intention, my focus, my energy, because the breath works with intention. You know the famous saying, what is it? With intention, where intention goes.
I thought it was where attention goes, energy flows. But I guess it works for intention as well.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be intention, but it doesn't matter either one. You know, where your intention and attention are essentially the same thing. What your intent is what you're attentive to.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I could use the breath to find the balance of finding, you know, my own personal love for myself. And so this is a way to navigate that. And so we have these for all the systems. So if I'm looking at relationships, I could look towards the Vayus. If I'm looking for like my energy through the day, I look at the gunas. There's three gunas. We have tamas or tamasic energy. I'm going to assume that not everybody is a yogic scholar in here. So the gunas is how the yogis discussed how energy was manifested in the universe. So everything in the universe is moving through these states of the gunas, these states of energy. And so these three states, you have rajas, sattva, and tama, or tamas. And the rajas energy, this is the energy that moves outwards, and it continues to move out and expand until it exhausts itself, right? And then to cycle within that, you have our tamas, and tamas gathers that together, consolidates it, and grounds it. And then between those two, when these are in balance, you have sattva. And sattva is moving upwards, as in growth. But the way that it really works in moving up, we think about it as this balance energy. But when energies are balanced, we have spiritual growth. And so the upward, as you think about moving up through the chakras, but from the heart chakra down, our lower chakras, which is more concerns of the body. And then from the heart chakra up, you have the spiritual chakras, right? Which is more concerned of your enlightened self. And so when we think about how Kundalini moves, it's the same way. It's when Ida and Pingala are imbalanced, Kundalini moves up the Sushumna channel. And that's the only way that Kundalini moves is if Ida and Pingala are imbalanced, which are, you know, another thing of energy that we think about. And so when we're talking about sattva, and there's so much focus, especially in yoga, like this misunderstanding of like, we always want to be sattvic, right? Because it sounds the best. How would you not just love to always be in this perfect place of balance and growth? But they're not meant to be like that.
Just like in the nervous system, we're not meant to be in our social engagement ventral all the time. Like we need the sympathetic response, and we need, you know, the collapse response, the freeze response is super helpful and case of you need it. And we tend to think that some of these states are less important than others and less like valuable. And it's the same in this case.
Exactly. So the gunas show the cycles of life and how we move through it. And they have, you could call them modes. So sattva is to be, rajas is to do, tamas is to have. And when they're all in balance, they flow through each other and they move in cycles, and you have a short cycle and a long cycle. You have different short cycles. You have a daily cycle. You wake up in a guna, you know, hopefully you wake up in either sattva or rajas, like either ready to go or feeling relaxed. You don't want to wake up in tamas.
You're not going to get up.
So you have that one, and that's going to change every couple hours. It's why we get a lull like in the middle of the day, because we're moving through this natural cycle of energies.
Is it a couple hours? Do you know if what's the exact number?
It's different for everybody.
Because within the nervous system, I think the research says 90 minutes that we switch like automatically. If you do nothing, there's going to be a switch every 90 minutes in your energy. So I was wondering if it would match with that.
For the gunas, I've read 2 hours, I've read 4 hours, I've read 6 hours.
Mm, okay.
I think with this, it's important not to get stuck onto any number.
Yeah, those little details.
This is a personal practice. So those things don't really matter that much, because you could change them. You could elongate, you could shorten based on your emotional response to the world and based on your breath and how you use it as a tool. Yeah. Then you have like your monthly cycle, which women are very in tune with this one because it follows along your
natural hormonal changes. So
in Bahasa, the word for the menstrual cycle is called Bulan Datang, which means the coming moon. So like your moon cycle, you know, because it follows along with that. But you think about like, I've been around women before, so even though I'm not a woman, I do understand. You have your time when you feel like crawling into bed and eating a pint of ice cream or whatever and being in that tamas state. And then you have times when you feel super energetic, and then also in between. And that's going to be affected by your hormonal cycle. Men have the same thing. It's just not as noticeable as women because we're not menstruating. We're not using all that energy to change the lining of our uterus. You know what I mean? And then you have a annual cycle, and we see that in the seasons. Obviously, winter is going to be a very tamasic kind of time to be inside. And then spring, very rajasic, right? Things are growing, things are doing. So we could look at these different things, and I could think about, well, what state do I want to go to sleep in? If you're more tamasic, it's going to be very easy to go to sleep. So I want to put myself in a tamasic state. Well, after that, as I go through and I wake up, I should wake up in either sattva or raja. So let's say if I wake up still feeling in tamas for whatever reason, maybe I didn't get enough sleep. There's a lot of factors that go into sleep, obviously, caffeine intake, exercise, breathing.
Sun exposure. Yeah, there's so many things.
So many different things. And in the book, I do talk about, so each one of the things, like the chapters I talk about, in the breath practices. I talk about like how to help yourself in your daily life outside of breathing, and then how to use breath as a tool, because again, it's the canvas and the brush. You have to have both. So you could use a breath practice and you wake up in the morning, which I do. I do an athletic breath performance practice. I wake up very early just naturally. I really have a hard time sleeping past 5:30. Might lay in bed until 6, but then by 6, I'm just like, I got to get up. And so I'll get up and I'll do an athletic breath performance practice.
Could you give us a couple examples of a breath that we could do, whether it's a pranayama or from another lineage, like why we choose them or for what purpose, just for people have ideas of what are those tools that we can use to kind of navigate our life and our intentions?
It's super simple. It really is. One of the big importances, and if we go back to James Nestor, I will give you a clear answer, but I need to give a little bit of background before I get to that clear answer on why it's important. So if you go back to James Nestor, he talked so much about breathing through the nose. And one of the main reasons is your CO2 tolerance. Your CO2 tolerance is like how long you could hold your breath before needing to breathe. And the higher your CO2 tolerance, the slower you're going to breathe naturally. It's a huge part of your health. If you breathe really fast, it's a sign of being unhealthy and having a low CO2 tolerance. And so there's a lot of things to go into. That's one of the reasons why I do athletic breath performances, because it works directly on that CO2 tolerance. When I am looking to, let's say, increase energy, I want to do a rapid type of breath. And so it's either going to be breath of fire, which is a fast, short inhale, exhale out through the nose, very shallow, moving very little air. You're not moving a ton of air out of the alveoli, or at least the deepest part of the lungs, which is why it's a really good practice, why it's a rapid breathing practice that you could do for much longer without getting so lightheaded, because you're not having as much gas exchange in that. So we could see this practice, how it's a rapid breathing practice, but we could also look like, okay, I normally breathe about 500 times per minute. If I'm doing breath of fire the right way, I'm only moving about 200 mLs at a time. And so it's working more into the dead space, which is going to be the air inside of your trachea and the bronchioles that don't go down into the alveoli where the gas exchange is happening. So I could do this rapid breath practice, just very quick, very shallow in and out through the nose. And this is going to help bring some alertness. If anybody's ever done anything like that, they're going to feel it. But after I do any kind of rapid breath practice, I have now decreased my carbon dioxide. So I become hypocapnic. This is bad because this works against my CO2 tolerance. And I go into really great detail on the science of this in the book. So anytime I do any kind of rapid breathing, I'm always going to want to follow that with a breath hold. If I just give you like a couple exercises, you know, like breathe fast in and out through the nose, either shallow, a little bit deeper. You can do it on the forced exhale, like Kapalabhati, which works different things, obviously, but just breathe fast in and out through the nose. It's going to give you energy. Whatever that is, it's going to put you into your sympathetic nervous system. And then you always want to follow the breath hold to bring the CO2 levels back to normal so that you don't affect your CO2 tolerance. That's a really simple practice. If you're feeling lethargic, you just need some energy, you want to be a little bit sharper, do 30 seconds to a minute of breath of fire in out through the nose, and then hold your breath 30 seconds to a minute until you feel like you need to breathe again. It's going to bring those CO2 levels up high enough, but you're still going to be in your sympathetic nervous system. Now, if I'm looking to be more relaxed, there's tools that I could use. I could breathe slower, so just elongate my breath. I could do a practice like Vishamavriti, which is ratio breathing. So I'd inhale for a certain count, I'd hold for a certain count, I'd exhale for a certain count, and then I'd hold again. And even within these, pretty much like getting more complicated into it, as you change the ratio of the breath, it's going to affect the nervous system slightly different. These are minor changes, but there is a difference between inhaling for 10 seconds, exhaling for 2 seconds versus inhaling for 2 seconds, exhaling for 10 seconds. They're both, I'm still breathing for 12 seconds per breath, but if I inhale, slowly exhale like that, I'm going to be much more relaxed versus if I take this long, slow inhale, then exhale real quick and then do that again, I'm going to be a lot more energized. And that goes back to what we talked about in the beginning. So if I'm looking to calm down, I want to focus on my exhale being longer than the inhale and adding a hold in there. This is why breath practices like 4-7-8, which I'm sure you've heard of before, which is a very common therapeutic practice. If you look at the science, you're inhaling for 4, you're holding for 7, you're exhaling for 8. And the way that I teach 4-7-8 is I exhale with pursed lip. So like where you exhale, like you're breathing through a straw. And there's a reason why you do that. So the first part of it, I'm inhaling, And then I hold. So as I hold, I'm lengthening the breath and I'm creating more parasympathetic tone. And then as I exhale slow, I'm still working into that parasympathetic tone. So I get almost a 4-to-1 ratio between the inhale and the exhale, which is very powerful to breathing into your parasympathetic nervous system. If I add the pursed-lip breathing into it, I create pressure inside, which then puts pressure on my vagus nerve. So you get something with a vagal response.
Yeah.
And your vagus nerve is the majority of your parasympathetic nervous system. So that's going to slow everything down. I worked as a paramedic for 8 years. And when we run on people that would have a condition called SVT, supraventricular tachycardia, which means our heart rate is just going really fast, we could give them like a syringe or something, or tell them to try to blow up their thumb. So they're pushing. And by creating this pressure inside, it stimulates the vagus nerve. So it's using the same science. None of the science is new. It's not like quack science. It's all stuff that's been proven by metadata analysis, hundreds and hundreds of studies out there. And so when I came into pranayama, I felt lost in it. I go to a yoga class and the teacher would be like, okay, let's do this practice followed by this practice. And there was no real reason behind it other than we'd start out with some Nadi Shodhana and then we'd do some Kapala Bhati or something like that, or maybe just one practice. The practice didn't link to the class. There was no explanation. Why am I doing alternate nostril breathing?
Yeah.
The air comes in the same thing. What is this doing? How is this affecting me? This is silly. I just thought that because when I started yoga, I already had the science background.
So you were already curious and you wanted to know more.
Yeah. None of that information was offered freely. Not that it wasn't out there.
No, but that was my experience too. I've asked a teacher before, how does this work? The answer I received was you don't need to know why. You just need to know that it does. And I was like, okay, but I would still like to know how. I understand. Yeah. So it's good to have access to that information. And I think that's why the book is so useful.
Yeah. I was never satisfied with that answer. That's probably if my biggest complaint about yoga in the history of yoga is one that you had a teacher that all your teachings are supposed to come from this teacher. And it's really bad form to ask the teacher questions.
Yeah. Cause you're questioning authority in a way that is disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really think you should question everything. And as a teacher, if you tell somebody to do something, you should explain why. I had two goals for the book. One was to give it to just people that want to practice and understand how to use the breath in a healthy way. And so I think I give 10 practices in the book. I break down each one of those practices, why you do it, why pick these exercises, how it works on the emotional level, how it works on the physiological level. But then in there, I teach you as a teacher, if you're a teacher, how to create a sequence. If you're a yoga teacher, you create a class, you have a warm up, you have a heat building sequence, you have a vitalizing or standing sequence, and you have a cool down.
Yeah. And you can do the same with your breath practice.
It has a flow. And with it, if I was teaching a class, my warm up, I wouldn't do all forward folds. And then in my heat building, I wouldn't do all back bends, and then in I would have an intention behind what I was going for. And so this allows you to move into it and also hopefully give people the freedom to change some of these practices. Remember, I said these ratios of the breath really affect how the nervous system works. And when you understand how to work within those ratios, you could take a practice, let's say a really powerful practice is humming deep breath, which is Brahmari breath. It's essentially you're humming, you're exhaling, creating a humming sound out through your nose. And you could do Shankara Mudra or whatever through it, which isn't necessary. You have this essential, there you go. So you have this practice, which is really powerful in creating nitric oxide. And nitric oxide has a lot of effects physiologically on the body. Helps with memory, helps with concentration, helps with learning, helps with sleep. It helps with sexual function. It's an adrenergic hormone and chemical that we produce in the body. It's mostly created in the paranasal sinuses, though it's created in all the epithelial cells throughout the body. But we can increase the production of this just by making a humming sound. So if I want to do that, it has all these different beautiful effects to it, but I really want to pinpoint it and make it really effective for what I'm doing. And so I could add that into other practices. Let's say I want something that is more clarity focused, just focus energy. I want to go into the sympathetic nervous system and increase the nitric oxide. So I could add this practice. I could do, let's say, we'll talk about breath of fire again. I could do breath of fire. right? I could do this for 30 seconds, inhale, hold for 15 seconds, and then do a nice slow exhale with Brahmari, with a humming bee breath, so that I start to build up that nitric oxide and then take another slow inhale and then move back into it. So I could blend practices together to really get the effect that I want.
Yeah, more knowledge gives you more agency and more empowerment and more control of what you're actually trying to do.
Yeah, exactly. If I'm thinking about like balancing energies, I want to balance my Ida, my Pingala, right? My creativity with my logic. I just want to feel more grounded and centered. Also want to add a little bit of relaxation into that, even more centeredness. So I could do Nadi Shodhana, alternate nostril breathing, and then also the same thing, exhale with the humming bee breath. It's ways like how you could bring them together. So as a teacher, you could start to pick these practices, and I lay it out. I do my best anyways to lay it out in graphs, so you could see, okay, well, these are the practices that increase energy. These are the practices that decrease energy. These are the practices that are good for these. And you could kind of start picking it apart. And then when you know the physiology, you're like, okay, I want to increase energy, but I don't want to increase CO2 for whatever reason. So I could look there and I go, okay, well, here's a practice, Agni Sar, which is part of Nali Kriya. This is where I work on an active exhale and I do like the vacuum breath, Uddiyana Bandha. I pull my belly in, and while holding it, I pump my belly in and out. Well, this is very sympathetic. And at the same time, I'm increasing CO2. So now I'm like, okay, well, I'm looking like I want to increase athletic performance in my breath. I actually have a whole second book plan just on athletic performance. Okay, I can do rapid breathing, but instead of holding my breath, I want to hold my breath and also increase sympathetic tone to get more energy. And so I could build up CO2 or increase my sympathetic tone. So it's just a resource to be there. And I started studying anatomy. I became an EMT when I was 18. And I started to get into anatomy then. I took a few years of anatomy and physiology in university after I got out of the military. And then I became a paramedic. And then my real study started when I became a yogi. And then I was like, okay, like hear all these practices and I feel the effects, but why do I feel them? And so that's a lot of time and effort. And most people aren't career yoga teachers. They just want to know how and why. So here's something like you don't need to memorize anything. You just flip to an easy chart, or you could just go to a practice. Or even now, like I have my own online platform out there and I release breath practices. So you could just go to my platform and then follow along. If you don't like reading or buying books, I have breakdown videos of explaining all this stuff in much more detail, each one of the breath practices. So
beautiful.
Yeah, just kind of like any teacher, like you want to teach, but you also want to be a resource.
So we'll put all of the links in the show notes for people to go and have access to this. If they want to work with you in some way, if they want to have access to those videos, obviously you can buy every other book. Where do they go? Where's the best place for them to find you or to work with you in some capacity?
DylanWernerYoga.com. That's also where my online platform is. That's where everything is. I offer one free class every month that changes. So if you're someone that doesn't want to spend any money, but you do want to practice with me at least once a month, you get a new class. Or if you sign up, then you have access to everything. Like since I'm teaching pretty much only online right now with like maybe one or two intensives, that's where I'm offering most everything. And then my book, you could buy anywhere where you could buy books. It's been translated now into German and Polish. I get messages all the time of people offering to translate the books, but it's kind of in the publishing part. Another publisher has to buy the rights to your book in that language and they do it. So if more people buy the book and it becomes more popular, then hopefully it'll be translated into more languages. I really love if any publishers are listening to this and you're a French publisher or a Spanish publisher, those two languages would be amazing.
Yeah. Reach out to me, guys. You know, I'll connect you. No problem. And go get the book, The Illuminated Breath. Thank you so much for your time, Dylan. We've talked about so many things and there's so much more, but we're going to wrap it up here for today. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you haven't already done so, please leave a review for this episode or the podcast in general on iTunes, as it really, really helps other sensitive souls and yogis find the podcast and use all and apply all these tools to their life. You'll find the show notes for today's episode at ericabelanger.com/224. And before you go, I just want to say a last thank you to the growing team behind this podcast and their support in making this possible. And this includes all our premium members. Without you guys, I would not be able to continue to do this since I choose to keep it ad-free for you. All right. Once again, thank you for listening. I'll see you next Monday.